Good evening, everyone. So with today we return to our normal schedule for Thursdays. So we sit for half an hour like we just did, and then we'll have about 45 minutes for a talk and maybe some discussion. And then we'll end with a short sitting. We try to aim for 15 minutes of sitting at the end, but it's usually quite a bit less. This is also the first regular meeting after the introductory course. And what I tend to do at the end of the introductory course is to continue with some of the basic themes, introductory themes, almost as if the introductory course never ended. And so that's what I'll do today. And the topic that I want to talk about is called the five hindrances. And the five hindrances are a theme which are talked about very frequently in the world of Vipassana, this kind of meditation practice that we do. If you ever go and do a residential retreat, a weekend or 5 day or 10 day or longer meditation retreat, there's always a talk somewhere near the beginning on the five hindrances. And the idea being that this is something that meditators need to become really familiar with. You can't become too familiar with this thing called the five hindrances. Before I actually talk about them, I wanted to mention that one of the principles of Vipassana meditation, of mindfulness meditation, is that we focus on more on actually what's happening as opposed to focusing on what we ideally hope would happen. People involved in spiritual practices tend to be, as a lot, somewhat idealistic. They have certain ideals they want to live by or experience or attain. And then it's very easy to kind of be focused and oriented around the ideals, and maybe put on certain kind of glasses. It only sees the ideals, or you measure yourself against the ideals and you fall short and you get disappointed in yourself, or there's a certain kind of ideal way of being that's supposed to be spiritual or something, and so we try to force ourselves into that kind of mode of being, sometimes even doing kind of violence to ourselves. But the way that Vipassana practice works is we don't focus. It's fine to learn about ideals and to hold them. They certainly have value in our lives. But the meditation practice itself is a practice of very honestly focusing on what the actual is. If there's a choice between the ideal and the actual, in Vipassana we always choose the actual, what's actually going on. So, and this works very nicely because another element of this principle is that in that the ideal is to be present in a relaxed and full way, we often find that we can't live up to that ideal. We're trying to be present and stay with our breath in the meditation the whole time, but how many of you were able to stay with every single breath for the full half hour? Who dares to say? Inevitably, the mind wanders away. And so rather than focusing on trying to create an ideal so much, part of the principle then is to focus on what is it that stands in the way, what blocks our ability to live by the ideal we want to live by. So for example, one of the ideals some people want to live by is the ideal of being fearless, not being a slave to your fears, and not to be inhibited or shy or whatever. And so some people then will try to muster up a certain amount of courage or bravado or whatever to kind of make their way through the life, to live by their ideal way. And in Buddhism, rather than trying to make us fearless directly by just being fearless, perhaps, that we tend to focus on what it is that keeps us from being fearless. We focus on the fear. And really clarify it and resolve it so it's no longer there as a problem. If we force ourselves to stick to an ideal of how we want to live, But actually who we are is we're, you know, something very different. So say we force ourselves to be fearless, but the fears are still really there, kind of eating at us and forcing us. There's a lot of effort and energy has to go into kind of pushing the fears aside so we can try to act in a fearless way. Or if your ideal is to be kind, and really you have a lot of hostility inside of yourself and a lot of judgments and whatever, and if you try to kind of put on a kind, friendly face and behave in a kind way, it might be a tremendous expense, very exhausting, because what you're trying to hold at bay is your hostility. So the principle in Buddhism is that rather than trying to be kind, even though it's a great ideal of Buddhism, we try very honestly and mindfully to look at what blocks the kindness, the hostility, the judgmentalism, the criticalness, or whatever it might be. And so that we can resolve it and deal with it, overcome it, get to the root of it and be finished with it, so it no longer stands in the way. Another ideal is the ideal of becoming concentrated. We want to become concentrated with our breath or with being in the present moment. And many of you have probably heard that concentration is an important element of meditation practice. So you say, well, I'm going to get concentrated. And to some degree, it's possible to develop concentration like it's possible to develop a muscle. But in the practice of vipassana, we don't so much do a frontal development of concentration as much as we pay careful attention to what it is that keeps us from being concentrated. And it's a beautiful thing, because two things happen then. If you pay attention to what keeps you from being concentrated, then you're concentrating on something. So you're developing concentration, right? That's great. So you're developing just something different than what you thought it should be. And the other is, you're really understanding some of the inner forces that govern your inner life. Your motivations, these powerful forces that drive us often. And so, if what keeps you from being concentrated, for example, is restlessness, and if you take and really hone in and look squarely in the face, your restlessness squarely in the face, and really see it for what it is, you might be able to resolve it and dissolve it, so it's no longer an issue. And then you'll find yourself much more easily concentrated, because you don't have this thing constantly pulling you away. So in Vipassana, Vipassana practice is really about paying attention to what's actually happening for us. And one of the ways that plays itself out is that we notice what it is that makes it difficult for us to do the practice. So the five hindrances are the five most common preoccupations that we get caught up in that make it hard for us to be present. When we're preoccupied by something, we can't really fully be present to what's happening now in the present moment, to ourselves, to what's happening around us. Now, the five hindrances are listed as desire, sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and anxiety, and the fifth one is doubt. Desire, ill will, all the forces of lethargy, all the forces of restlessness, all the forces of doubt. And what you'll find as you continue doing this practice is that these are the most commonly reoccurring powerful preoccupations that make it difficult for us to be present. So part of the practice then becomes being very honest about the hindrances, being very honest about recognizing them when they occur in us, and really learning how to bring mindful attention to those in a kind and accepting and generous way, as opposed to some attitudes of meditators would be to be critical or angry, upset with them, and think of them as the enemy and the problem. The five hindrances are not just simply forces in meditation, but they are also forces of everyday life. And it's very common for people to be preoccupied with their desires, with their peeves, what they have ill will or aversion to. It's very common for people to be preoccupied with their sloth and torpor. Sloth and torpor often arises out of resistance. We're not talking about normal tiredness here. And then there is We often get preoccupied with forces of anxiety, and we often get preoccupied with doubt, with uncertainty and insecurity. So a mindfulness meditator is becoming an expert on these five forces. Allison, could I also have a glass of water? Thank you. I have a dry mouth today. Now it's interesting that the word, the Buddhist word for the five hindrances, is not literally hindrance, which is the English translation, but nivarana in Pali literally means in English the coverings. So it's the five coverings. And I like that because it kind of indicates better what actually their function is in our lives. They tend to cover up our awareness. They cover up our ability to see clearly what's going on in the present moment. They cover up some part of ourselves. Thank you. Thank you. And in that part of us is covered, we don't have a very whole sense of who we are. The holistic aspect of who we are then is covered. One of the ways in which we cover ourselves and don't really see ourselves clearly for who we are is to be excessively idealistic, to have an ideal which we try to live by or measure ourselves by. And then if we live, ideals are wonderful things to have because they can inspire us and show us our potential. But on the other hand, ideals can also make us blind to that part of ourselves which doesn't live up to it. So if the ideal, in Buddhist circles, for example, one of the ideals is to be kind. Buddhists kind of like put a high value on being kind. But when you have any system where there's a high value on something like kindness or a high value on anything, then the opposite tends to get devalued. And so you don't want to show your Buddhist friends what's devalued in their scene, right? So if you feel like some hostility of being unkind, you don't want to show it around your Buddhist. You save that for your, you know. And so it's one of the unfortunate things, of course, about Buddhist groups is that this, you know, in the focus on an ideal sometimes can prevent us from then really being honest about who we really are and seeing that part of ourselves. We can cover ourselves through our ideals. Or perhaps we have a high ideal for that we want to live by, and we measure ourselves negatively by it. You don't live up to it. And then what might be happening is what you're covering up is your beauty, some real strength and something really precious inside of you that somehow never gets a chance to come to the surface, to the light, because you're so constantly preoccupied by how you're not living up to some ideal. So the five coverings. And it isn't that in mindfulness practice we have to get rid of these five coverings. It isn't that they themselves are the problem. What's the problem is our tendency to be preoccupied with them, our tendency to be absorbed and caught up in them and lost in them. And we know it's all too easy to get lost in desire. It's all too easy to get lost in aversion. I think one of the very important principles that I try to live by, I do especially with aversion and anger, is I try not to make a decision when I'm in the throes of being angry. I try not to have a conversation with my wife about some problem we're having while I'm angry. I try to process what's going on, and I'll come back and talk about the situation as soon as the anger is passed. Because what I found over and over again in my life is that if I make a decision about something to say or something to do while I'm angry, I'm often making the decision through a filter where I don't see the situation very clearly. And the same thing, of course, happens with the desire. I mean, how many of us have bought something, you know, in the wonderful allure of how wonderful this thing is and how it's going to do for us, and we bring it home and say, what did I buy that for? You know, there's all kinds of desires we might have. It's useful to look at these five forces also as five strategies of avoidance. Human beings don't like to be uncomfortable. And in that we don't like to be uncomfortable, we often create strategies for ourselves to try to avoid the discomfort or do somehow react against it or towards it or something. And the five hindrances can be understood as strategies of avoiding discomfort or uncomfortable situations. So, for example, desire is a classic one, right? If you're uncomfortable, if you're feeling lonely, head for the refrigerator is a classic myth or classic kind of stereotype in cartoons in American culture, right? And I don't know about in real life, but this kind of this little myth in America, right? You go for the refrigerator when you're upset. And people put signs on the refrigerator, you know, reminding themselves to don't eat so much or whatever. But so people go shopping is another idea people have. People go, you know, do all kinds of things. They, as a compensation or as a result of being uncomfortable in some personal way, being lonely, being insecure, being feeling kind of empty or feeling afraid or feeling anxious or whatever, people sometimes will look outside of themselves for something to soothe them. And it can be television, it can be sex, it can be food, it can be pursuing money. It can be anything that somehow you think that's going to make me happy. Now, addiction is a classic form of this. And there's a lot of addiction in American culture, as we all know. Addiction is, you know, looking out for something outside of ourselves that's going to make us happy. What the addictive quality often does is it brings us pleasure, but not happiness. And so there's confusion between happiness and pleasure. And so you might ask, well, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with pursuing some pleasure when I'm feeling uncomfortable? One of the problems with it is that it tends to alienate ourselves from what's happening with us, what's actually going on. If what we're doing is feeling lonely or feeling insecure or feeling a little bit off, the Buddhist principle is that it's much more valuable to bring your careful, honest attention to that and find how to settle yourself in the middle of it, find your peace in the middle of it, than it is to look outside of yourself for something to soothe you with, which is what we often do, don't we? We confuse external soothing for real happiness, which can only arise from the inside. And because of that confusion, people can go from one desire to another. The nature of desires is they often don't satisfy the deep yearnings of the heart, even though we're trying to make them satisfy it. And so we go out and try to do all these different things, and temporarily we have some success, maybe, or feel some soothing, but then that inner yearning, inner emptiness is still there, and so we go look for something else. If that's what we think it's going to be. It's only by stepping back from all the things we can get in life, the recreational opportunities, and money, and jobs, and foods, and relationships, and all things which are outside, and find some way to be settled on ourselves that we'll really find great happiness. So the forces of desire take us away from ourselves, alienate ourselves from ourselves. And I've known people who've been so much pursuing desire that they really no longer know who they are themselves. So the same thing with aversion, with ill will. Sometimes aversion or ill will is a way of covering some kind of inner discomfort that we have. We feel uncomfortable in a situation, and it's a lot better to criticize and blame something outside of you, be angry at something outside of you, than it is to take responsibility for yourself and find some way to settle yourself on yourself. So the way the strategy works, you know, kind of a silly example would be in meditation. Is say you're sitting in meditation and you feel somewhat uncomfortable in your meditation posture, or somewhat uncomfortable in your being sitting here. So you don't like, so you want to escape, you want to get away from it somehow. So there's two great strategies, desire and aversion. One would be, say you're a little bit uncomfortable on your cushion sitting here, so you can spend the next half an hour on your meditation daydreaming, designing the perfect meditation cushion. You can make, you know, hot water, you know, and a nice water zafu that has a thermometer in it, and the temperature to adjust itself, and people can get lost in this world of fantasy and desire to somehow appease and soothe the discomfort rather than being really honest and being present for it as it actually is. Or if you're more the aversion type, you might spend the half an hour designing the perfect way of destroying your zafu, your cushion. How are you going to take it home and tear it up 100,000 parts and then burn it, and Or maybe you go further afield and you start criticizing the person who made it and the person who designed it, and then maybe the Buddhist tradition for having them and the Buddhist tradition for even inventing meditation. And mind can be very creative in coming up with aversion. Some people are aversion types, some people are desire types, and so off we go. But aversion also can work both subtly and very grossly as a way for us to avoid being honest with ourselves and being honest with what's going on in the present moment. It's a lot more, sometimes a lot more comforting to blame someone and be critical than it is to really settle on oneself and really feel what's going on for oneself, in oneself. And then there's sloth and torpor, which are also strategies of covering things up, the great cover-up of avoidance. And one of the clear kind of examples that maybe I can give for this is what I call my seer's mind. When I was 10 or 11 or 12, my mother would take me to Sears to go shopping for clothes. And I hated it. It was like, you know, so we would walk into the front doors of the Sears department store, and I would immediately get lethargic. You know, drag my feet and whine, we have to, you know, come on, please, let's go. And I would get really, I'm so tired, you know, it's too much. And then we'd leave Sears, and my mom would say, you know, would you like some ice cream or something? I'll be as awake as ever, you know. There's nothing wrong with me. And the tiredness and the lethargy of going into Sears was really a strategy that I had developed of resistance, of avoidance. And sometimes it can be very clear, very obvious with children, this is playing itself out. Of course, it's a lot less obvious in ourselves as adults, who are not supposed to be doing this. To see that we do it still is, of course, not so easy. But it is often the case that that a certain level of lethargy, of sloth and torpor in our practice, in our life, is often a form of resistance, a form of not really paying attention to what's really, truly going on. Some kind of an attempt not to be fully honest with what's going on. So the question then is, when you feel sloth and torpor, not just simply tiredness because you're tired or sleepy, but this kind of lethargy, is it perhaps, can you investigate it? Can you get to know it better? And is it, to some degree, a strategy that you have that is really avoiding real honesty with yourself? Anxiety and restlessness is a classic avoidance mechanism. To run around being anxious rather than really being settled and honest about what's really actually going on. I've heard of people who will worry a lot. I've heard a few people who've said that they learned growing up in their family that they can only really express their care of other people in their family if they show that they were worrying about them. So the only way they knew how to express love was to worry a lot. And so that was, you know, kind of a maladaptive way of expressing care and concern. And if you weren't worrying, then you didn't care, was the kind of message that some people have gotten. But anxiety. The classic understanding in Buddhism is that people feel anxious and restless because they've done something wrong, because they've actually harmed someone. They've actually done some actual physical or psychological harm to some other human being. And so there's a certain level of kind of remorse or fear that you get caught, or people will notice that you've done this bad thing, harmful thing. And so this is a source of restlessness and anxieties. And so the antidote to this was to live a moral life, to live a virtuous life that we really tried not to harm anyone else. This antidote to anxiety and restlessness doesn't work so well in America, because a lot of Americans don't have to do anything wrong to feel something's wrong with them. it just seems to be kind of like, you know, it's the nature of the universe, right? That you were created in such a way that you are the one person who somehow doesn't have, you know, or something wrong with you, and you're not quite adequate as a human being, or you're not really worthy as a human being, and You know, and if people really, you know, you don't really want to let other people know who you really are, because then they would reject you, because if they really find out who you were, then they'd realize that you're not really a full, worthy human being. I don't know if that's exactly stating it very well, but there's a phenomenal amount of generic insecurity and lack of self-worth in American culture, where people assume that that's inherently who they are, rather than feeling bad about themselves for something that they've actually done, which is in some sense healthy. They feel bad about themselves just because they're alive. And so meditation practice in this sense, mindfulness practice, is meant to be a cure of that. Is for us to really get to really be really honest about our level of anxiety that we have, insecurity, worry, restlessness we have about ourselves and life, and really be present for it and see if we can see through it and see to something more beautiful about ourselves than this restlessness and anxiety, which is always on the surface of our being, not in the depths. And then there's doubt. Doubt is said to be the most serious of the hindrances, the most problematic one. Partly because doubt is the one that will take people away from the practice. Take people away from the investigation to really look honestly what's really going on now. If you really believe your doubt, then people will sometimes give up. But doubt is a very, very powerful preoccupation. It keeps people, it causes people to hesitate, to hold back. It causes people to be indecisive. And it causes people to give up many things. A person can have doubt in many different things. A person can have doubt in themselves. They can have a doubt in, for example, a spiritual practice they're doing. They can have doubt in the spiritual tradition they're involved in. They can have doubt that this is the right weather to be doing the meditation, or the right time of day, or the right cushion, or the right amount of lighting. Or maybe, they have doubt whether they ate the right thing that morning in order to do meditation. Or, doubt whether this is the time to do meditation or whether it's the time to defrost the freezer. There's a lot of doubts that we might have. And it's very easy to get caught up in them and believe them. And what's supposed to happen in meditation practice is that we have to be able to see, we have to learn to see and identify doubt for what it is. Oh, there's my friend doubt. Oh, there's doubt. And to see doubt is just a bunch of thoughts and ideas passing through our mind. And that it's possible to let them pass through the mind without us getting involved with them. Like getting on those trains as they go by. It's possible to have doubt occur and not to believe it. This was very important for me when I was doing my dissertation. Dissertations are notorious for being stress-producing, I think, for many people. And I think it's quite common for people who do dissertations, especially in humanities, to feel like it's hopeless, that you can't do it, and it's too much, and you can never do enough, you can never know enough. You can never do enough research. You can never be smart enough with your ideas. And you can never do enough. So it seems to be how it's designed, almost the whole system. And so I certainly had my doubts as I was doing my dissertation. And these little voices would come through and say, this is hopeless. I should give up. And I'll never finish. And I'll never understand this particular issue or do this and that. And because I had done a lot of meditation practice, I could see these these little voices of doubt arise, and I would just let them be in the background. I would ignore them, completely ignore them. They were like little pesky little flies in the background, and I just continued with doing the tasks that were in front of me that had to be done. I think that many years ago, before I had the training in mindfulness, I wouldn't have seen those little voices of doubt so clearly, and they would have been entwined with the rest of me, with the rest of my consciousness, with my decision-making, that I would have been making decisions based on them as if I believed them. I would have believed the doubts many years ago. Now I see them as thoughts that are passing through, and I don't have to believe them. And if I think there's some validity to them, I might spend some time carefully and honestly reflecting about them. But if without that kind of clear reflection, doubts often lead us astray. So part of the power of the meditation practice is to stay focused and present without giving any fuel or any direction or any power or any involvement in our doubts. You can be sitting here. It's really great to be doing a meditation practice. And you're sitting here. Occasionally you might sit in meditation and say, this is not working, I can't do this, this is the wrong day, this is the wrong hour, this is the wrong minute, this is the wrong whatever. Or, and you should just, okay, that's a doubt. Gil talked about doubts. That's a doubt. I'll just name it, that's a doubt. And then I'm just going to continue regardless. I'm not going to let my meditation practice be measured by anything that can be called a doubt. Isn't that great? That begins providing a person with a kind of inner strength that will translate into tremendous helpfulness in your normal life. Because in normal life, you often have doubts also. And if you've learned and trained yourself to some degree not to believe your doubts, you learn to recognize them when they arise, and learn how to kind of keep a steady course, even when the doubts are present, you get through life a lot easier than if you get caught up in your doubts. So this principle applies to the other four hindrances also. And that is, we need to learn to recognize them and be very honest and see them coming. And then learn how not to get involved in them, not to get caught up in them, but just see them for what they are. There's desire. Oh, my friend desire. I had desire many times before. Maybe I don't have to believe the desire. Maybe I don't have to feel like I have to go chase after it or tie my thoughts and my fantasies to trying to fulfill that desire. I just let the desire, I can see it clearly for what it is and come back to the breath, come back to the present moment. The ability to be familiar with the five hindrances, with desire and ill will, to really get to know them well, helps us to become free of them. So this is also kind of bad news, of course, because many of us would like to be free of these forces. And what is being said is that you have to really get to know them well, which means that you have to allow them to be there a little bit. You can't be pushing them away or wishing them away quickly, but rather you have to use the mindfulness to help you really get to know them well. And the better you get to know them, the more independent you'll be of them. And your independence of them will give you freedom then not to be slaves to them, be caught up in them. It's inevitable when people meditate that the five hindrances will appear. And this is a very important thing to say, because many of you, especially if you're new in meditation, will be sitting here trying to stay present with your breathing, trying to stay present in the mindfulness practice. And your mind will get preoccupied with desire and ill will and fantasy and all these things. And some of you will think, oh, I can't do this. It's hopeless. You know, everyone else is able to stay present, but I have all these things that can make it really difficult for me. Actually, you're not any different from anyone else. Everyone's having these things happening to them. And what the practice is to, when these things occur, is to bring the mindfulness to clearly see and recognize those things. So they become part of the practice rather than something that takes you away from the practice. Or to say it a different way, the very thing that takes us away from being present is where we develop our presence. Isn't that great? I think that's really great. The very thing that takes us away from being present is where we develop our presence. So when you start getting carried away in something, getting carried away from the present moment by your preoccupation, and you notice that, you don't need to judge yourself or criticize yourself for that. You're given a golden opportunity that moment when you start waking up again. Here is something that's happening in the present moment I can get to know really well. I can get to know desire. I can get to know ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness, and wake up in the middle of it. Can I have some more, please? I'm really thirsty tonight. I've been taking antibiotics. I think that's been making me really thirsty. I took my last one this afternoon. That's why I wasn't here last week. I had an abscess on my tonsil. It was kind of painful. So, so in that, the practice then is to involves also being present for these things when they occur. Part of the skill we're trying to learn in meditation is how to be present for these things without being caught up in them, without being entangled with them, without getting swept up and lost in them. One of the most useful ways of doing this is... Thank you. Is to feel what it's like to have these forces in the body. What's the physical embodied feelings connected to these things? Desire is not just simply an abstraction of the mind, but the stronger the preoccupation with the desire, the stronger you can sense and feel a tightening, a constriction, an uplifting kind of forward, perhaps leaning of our gravity, of our presence. There's a way in which we get caught up physically when we get caught up in desire or ill will and aversion. What does it feel like in the body to have anger? What does it feel like in the body to have hostility or ill will? A tightening in the stomach or heat or pushing away? Or how does it feel? Sloth and torpor, you know, is a very physical event. You can feel very carefully the heaviness, the heat perhaps, or the dullness, or the mud-like mind that you might have. But to actually feel and explore these things, to really, the more honestly you can feel them in the body, the more you tend to be independent of it. Anxiety and restlessness is completely about something in the body. It's, I mean, not completely, but huge. It's very easy to find the restless and anxious energies in, coursing through the body. And it's one of the really lovely things to do in meditation, is when you find yourself being anxious or restless, is to actually sit very still in meditation. Don't move. Be committed to not moving. And then kind of relax, kind of in a sense, kind of open your body up to feel the energies, the sensations of restlessness and anxiety as they course through your body. And you might feel like you're going to bolt. You know, you're about to jump up and, you know, run out the door. You might feel all kinds of powerful things inside of you. And you're committed to sitting there and being the container for it and letting these energies kind of course and move. And you don't try to inhibit any of it. You don't try to repress it or hold it back. But you let these things kind of move and spark and flash and course through you. And the more honestly and more fully you can hold these things and let these move this in you, the quicker you'll find the body just relaxes. It's really great. Have any of you had that experience? It's really great just to feel it. Now, if you run around and be anxious, run between the television and the radio and the refrigerator and just try to do everything, you know, you'll just get more and more anxious. But if you sit down and really feel your anxiety in your body in a complete and full way, you'll find that you relax much more quickly. Doubt is perhaps more difficult because doubt is so cognitive in nature, so much to do with thoughts. Maybe it doesn't find the same basis in the body. Again, it's really, you have to be really honest and notice that this is a thought. What is the nature of your thoughts? We tend to believe our thoughts so easily and so readily. Are thoughts something which are asking to be believed? Are thoughts something that need to be believed? Are thoughts something which need to be in the center of our life? Or can thoughts be an adjunct to our life that's helpful, and if they're not helpful, you leave them aside? The spirit of mindfulness practice is a spirit of kindness, of friendliness. And this translates into how we relate to these hindrances. And it's a powerful thing to do, to try to bring some kind presence to what's going on, kind presence to our aversion, our anger, our ill will, kind presence to our desires and our restlessness and all these things. Because the very source of the hindrances, what gives them power, it often arises out of a way we've chosen to relate to the world. And if we begin to learn how to relate in a way that's as kinder or more accepting or more allowing, you'll find that that very new attitude will tend to help you settle much more deeply inside of yourself, settle on yourself in a way that the hindrances won't have as much power over you. The five coverings. When the five coverings arise, you might ask yourself, what is this covering? What is this covering up? What is a cover up for? When you're powerfully motivated by desire, is that covering something else that's more central to your life? When you're consumed by ill will, what is it covering up? What are you avoiding about yourself? When you're restless and anxious, what's it covering? When you're filled with lethargy, what's it covering? When you're depressed. One of the interesting questions to ask when you're depressed is, what is it that really wants to be expressed here? And if you sit and meditate for half an hour, and then in the middle of your depression, when you're depressed, sit and meditate for half an hour, and when you get as quiet and as calm as you can get, which might not be very, but you get as quiet, as calm, as settled as you can in meditation, then pop this question to yourself. What is it that wants to be expressed here? And there are some forms of depression that are a kind of repression. They're kind of holding something at bay. And it might be anger. You might actually have a lot of anger or a lot of disappointment that you don't want to really feel. And so all that energy is kind of bottled up. And the depressive kind of energy of depression is actually a form of holding something at bay. And to ask, what is it being covered? What is it that wants to be expressed underneath that covering? Sometimes can give permission for that deeper energy to surface and show itself. And in the end, as we become more skillful, more familiar with these five hindrances, get to know them really well, we begin finding that we don't have to buy into them. We find a kind of presence and a kind of stability, a kind of settledness in our life that's independent of these forces which drive many, many people. And I'll end with a little story from the ancient discourses of the Buddha. In Buddhism, in the ancient Buddhism, there was a notion of a being called Mara. And Mara is kind of like the Buddhist equivalent of the devil. Mara's job description is to prevent people from becoming enlightened. That's what he or she is supposed to do. So, on the night that the Buddha was enlightened, there was a tremendous kind of battle between the Buddha, and kind of a battle between the Buddha and Mara. Mara tried really hard to prevent the Buddha from getting enlightened. And Mara failed, luckily for us, and the Buddha was enlightened. And then you think, you know, he lived happily ever after. Now, in the Buddhist tradition, it's often, even the ancient tradition was understood, one of the understandings was that Mara was really the personification of inner psychic forces. Just a kind of convenient way, kind of fairy tale way of talking about inner psychic forces. And then what's interesting is after the Buddha was enlightened, there are stories where Mara still comes to visit the Buddha. So I thought it was kind of odd, you know, I thought the Buddha was completely enlightened and free of all these inner psychic forces of disturbances and hindrances and everything. What's Mara doing visiting the Buddha after he's enlightened? And maybe what's interesting is that maybe the Buddha is not so different than all of us. Maybe the Buddha has the same forces as well us have, the same anxieties, the same maybe forces of distraction, desire. But what was interesting was what the Buddha did when Mara came to visit. The Buddha didn't put up a great psychic wall and repression and avoidance. The Buddha didn't attack with all, you know, his weapons he could find. The Buddha also did not invite Mara in for tea and spend the night and, you know, let's become partners and have a merger and, you know. But rather, what the Buddha did was, all he did was he said, Mara, I see you. Without any hostility or any, it was kind of a kind way of saying it, Mara, I see you. And every time the Buddha would say that, Mara would run away. So what the practice is helping us to do is to have that presence of mind and that that dedication to honesty, where we can see what's going on and name it really clearly. And if you see something really clearly for what it is, it loses its power. These inner psychic forces, Mara-like forces inside of us, the hindrances. And then you can live your life a lot easier. So you'll find yourself settling and relaxing much deeper in your meditation if you will learn to recognize these hindrances when they first arise, so that you don't get carried away and swept up in them. So please become experts in desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and anxiety, and doubt. So we can take maybe a couple of questions or concerns or that you might have. Yes?
A very anxious and doubtful day, and it was physically apparent, and I thought, actually I don't really know if I don't want this job, or maybe it's just all the anxiety that is attends doing a resume and letters, trying not to make any typos. And so can you say something about how to distinguish between the two?
Maybe it's important to distinguish between doubt and our preoccupation with doubt. Preoccupation means that we're lost in the doubt, or it's kind of motivating us, and you know, we're caught up in it and making us anxious. Uncertainty is a huge part of life. If you're not comfortable with uncertainty, you won't be uncomfortable with life. You'll never be comfortable with life. You know, uncertainty is built into life, right? We can't, you know, and any philosophy that's going to say that there's no, that it's going to provide you with absolute certainty about life is just a setup for suffering. So uncertainty is part of life. Not knowing what to do about a job is a reasonable thing, you know, whether to take the job or something, it's a reasonable thing to have. What you need to do is be very honest about how you're relating to that uncertainty and the questioning and the investigation that you have to do to decide what you want to do. Are you getting anxious and caught up in doubt? Is the doubt kind of swirling around and making you a little bit blind? If that's the case, then you're in the throes of a hindrance. And the practice is not so much an antidote to being uncertain and doing the kind of homework you have to do to figure out what the answers are, but the practice is an antidote for being preoccupied and caught up in that. So one of the best things, one of the things you might do, for example, is First of all, it can be very valuable to know that it's possible to make decisions without being anxious. And actually, you probably make better decisions if you weren't anxious. And many people kind of might know that kind of intellectually, but don't really know that deep inside. And so they feel like somehow they have to get anxious because they don't know any other way to kind of relate to the problem. But if you really can know for yourself, there's other ways of relating to this problem you have, then maybe you can do away, you can avoid having being anxious. And one of the other ways is to sit and meditate. You might take 5 minutes, it's all it might take, or it might take longer, and sit down in the middle of doing your resume and say, what's going on, and really feel honestly what's going on with you, and feel the forces of anxiety, feel the forces of doubt inside of you, and see if it's possible if you can settle them by being really honest and feeling them as they are, maybe breathing through them or into them. And then once your fears around all this have abated to some degree, then you have much more clarity. And then you might find that the answers that you're looking for something as important as a job might not come from even from a rational place where you figure things out, but it might bubble up from your chest. Somehow it is feeling in your chest bubble and says, oh, that's what I really, that seems really right. Oh no, that really feels wrong for me. And I can't really give a good reason for that, but you know, I don't think I want to sacrifice my precious human years doing something which doesn't really nourish me or doesn't really nourish other people or doesn't really speak to my heart's deepest wishes. But if we're running around in our thoughts and our anxiety, we don't give our heart a chance to really to have its say. Does it make some sense?
So you're saying basically that I'll know the difference. If I can get quiet enough, I'll find the difference. Doubt that I can let go and the inner voice that I need to pay attention to.
Right. And some decisions might take weeks and months to kind of ruminating and thinking about, but there's no need to feel anxious about it. Anxiety is extra. Yes?
You mainly talked about looking at your feelings and your emotions as they appear in the present. If you look at a lot of the popular psychologists, a lot of psychologists talk about things like the inner child, the divine child, and how...
I'm interested in the inner adult.
Well, that grows out of the inner child, supposedly. Their advice there is that you'll never really get rid of some concerns in the future, I mean in the present, unless you go back to childhood and go to some of those original either anxiety or anger or fear-producing situations, relive those, you know, resolve them, work them through. So I'm wondering, when you say look at your fear in the present, does the Buddhist sort of investigation allow you that going back and reliving?
Well, one thing that stood out in what you said in the beginning was you used the word, he says something like, some things will never be resolved unless you go back to your childhood memories.
Right.
And then there's the cliche, you know, never say never. I'm reluctant to kind of make an absolute statement. Some people find a lot of help in reliving and reconstructing the memories they have from their childhood and understanding better the forces that influence and shape them. And for some people, it's really valuable to do that. It doesn't mean that's the only way that they can resolve some of those issues. It's one valuable way sometimes. There's a shortcoming to this, is that even though it's valuable for some people, in that some people make kind of this have a tendency to absolutize. Some people will try to approach all their problems from that point of view. Oh, there's always something in my past. And they'll never take responsibility for what they're doing now. They'll blame it on their past. And there's all kinds of course, problems with this approach also, even though it has its usefulness. And part of the relief that the Buddhist practice has given to some psychologists and certainly people in the West is to give them another way of resolving some of their deeper conflicts inside of them without having to reconstruct the past, without having to go back and revisit the past. Because this shouldn't be said briefly or too simply because it's hard to understand. But our suffering is something that we create for ourselves in the present moment. Unless it's like some kind of physical trauma or trauma which is kind of embedded in our nerves, which is sometimes the case. It isn't that that something happened to us 20, 30, 40 years ago, and that's now that is causing us to suffer now. But rather, we in the present moment, in very subtle corners of the mind, are reacting and responding, and then choosing to do something which causes suffering in the present moment. So the actual roots of suffering, the conditions might be in the past, but the roots of actually what's causing suffering occurring in the present moment. So as the mindfulness gets stronger and stronger, it needs to be very strong. And because it's possible to get into the very roots of what's happening in the present moment for us, that's recreating and recreating and creating that suffering in the present moment. And you might never understand the history of it in order to resolve it. You don't necessarily need to understand the history of it in order to resolve. It's possible to resolve these deep inner conflicts without going back into the history. Does this make some sense?
I think it's good that Buddhism provides a couple of techniques. So it's up to the person to say, hey, what's going to be helpful? Let's be pragmatic, like
right.
You said. And for some people, it will be the focus on the past, but Buddhism offers
right.
Look deeply at the present also.
Right. Right. Buddhism itself is very pragmatically oriented, and Most Buddhist teachers I know are very comfortable recommending that some people do therapy, for example, if they're really stuck, and that seems to be the thing which will kind of shake them loose a little bit. Yes?
I find that starting out in meditation, starting out by asking myself how I'm feeling and getting with that brings me very often much more into the present, certainly much more interesting than trying to stay with the breath.
Great.
So go ahead and go with that?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
That answers my question.
The breath is a kind of a very common means of helping us get into the present, because people, when they first sit down, are so scattered. But if you have another way of doing it, like, you know, feelings, it's great. It might be a lot easier. The danger with something like that is that it's very easy for many of us, if we pay attention to our feelings, is to get involved with all the ideas and stories we have about our feelings. And so we were present for a moment there, and then we're, you know, reconstructing what happened earlier today and what I should have said. And so you have to be careful, just stay in the present with what's actually going on. Enough talking? Good. Well, let's end then with a very short sitting. our preoccupations always cover that which is most beautiful inside of us. If you're preoccupied by something, you can't really be in touch with your beauty. If you let go of your preoccupations, then your beauty has a chance to show itself. Thank you and good night, and I look forward to seeing you next week.